You can turn to Ecclesiastes, chapter 3. We're going to pick it up in verse 16. And then we're going to work our way through chapter 4 to verse 16. If you're new with us, this book was written by presumably Solomon. Not everybody agrees, but it's a book that is searching out the purpose of life and the mysteries of life and looking at what is worthwhile under the sun. Last week, we looked at the mystery of time and how it can be elusive. One of the words that the author uses consistently in this book is the word vanity, and it can mean breath or a vapor. And if you think of a breath, if you think of just a little fire in your backyard, and not a wildfire, but one that's contained. And if you've got little kids, sometimes they like to have their smoke sticks in there and pull it out. And if you look at smoke, if you try to grab it, it's elusive. It runs away from your fingers, and life is like that. As we try to grab hold of life, it's challenging to try to take hold of. And time is like that. We want to cling to time and hold on to moments in time and the aspects of time, and yet there's elusive parts of it. And so he talked about that. There's also painful parts of time. And yet, as one preacher expressed and illustrated, God has woven into our life different ingredients, different parts of time. So how many of you enjoy cookies? You like cookies. How many of you like eating flour? Or a stick of butter, just by itself. Like, I like butter, but I've never just taken a teaspoonful of it and just put it in my mouth. I like it on things, but by itself, that's not something that I enjoy. And yet you combine the ingredients and you can have something really wonderful and tasteful and good. And life is like that. There are some things by themselves that are bitter, that are not enjoyable, that are unpleasant, but God weaves them into his great plan and he makes out something beautiful in the end. Solomon is going to take some more time today to talk about the more troubling aspects of life. You could title this section, Born to Trouble. And I'm borrowing that from the book of Job, chapter 5, verse 7, where Job himself says, man is born to trouble as sparks fly upward. It's synonymous with life, pain. We don't remember it, but our mothers do, that it was connected with just our entrance into life. From the moment we arrived, pain was part of the process. Pain was part of something that we experienced and was experienced by those around us. Think of all the occupations just in this world that deal with trouble. I have two brothers who are firefighters. Their entire career and role is dealing with trouble. 911 calls. If there was no trouble in this world, they would be unemployed. That's all they deal with. All these calls. I have another sister who, she's a nurse. And certainly there's aspects of health where there might not be trouble and you're helping somebody just to get to another degree of health or fitness. But her job largely is dealing with the trouble side of health when health has been broken. And if you think of other career fields, mechanics. Some people like to tinker and, you know, tool, but usually when I take my vehicle to the mechanic, it's because there's trouble with my vehicle. We have one of our vehicles in the shop right now. I've received the quote of how much it's going to cost, and there's trouble in this world. Military. It's a huge aspect of governments, and yet it exists and it needs to exist because of trouble, to be a restraining influence on trouble and evil and problems in this world, and encountering it and dealing with it. And so this is something that Solomon, or the author of this book, is going to address. How do we respond to it? How do we cope? I mean, there's no epidural for the duration of life. I can't just get a drip of morphine for the rest of my life. I mean, some of us would like that, just to inoculate ourselves and try to put ourselves to sleep to the reality of some of the pain in this world. How do we deal with it? Solomon addresses that here. Or I keep saying Solomon. That's the preacher. So, verse 16, he's going to talk about how, in spite of trouble, we can still rejoice. Verses 16 through 22. Moreover, chapter 3, I saw under the sun in a place of judgment or justice, wickedness was there. And in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there shall be a time there for every purpose and for every work. I said in my heart, concerning the estate of the sons of men, God tests them, that they may see that they themselves are like beasts. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to beasts. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over the beasts, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from dust, and all return to dust. Who knows, or who knows whether, the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, and the spirit of the beast, which goes down to the earth? So I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, and that is, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? We can spend a great deal of our lives worrying about trouble. And that's part of what Solomon is talking about here, the preacher. Or we can spend our lives focusing on our task in the midst of trouble. That we are born to trouble. We are born to combat it. We cannot completely overcome it on our own. But we've been given a task and we can rejoice in that task. So that's his focus here. He talks about recognizing reality, where we live, in verses 16 and 17. He says, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. I don't think he's just talking about the pockets in this world, where he's looking at specific places like court systems or governments or homes or neighborhoods. And that can be the place, and that can be the case, where we are looking for justice, we're looking for righteousness, and the court system does not give the verdict that we know is actually a just verdict. There's something wrong with the decision that was made, or whatever else. But I think he's not just talking only about the specific places. He's talking about this place that we live in, under the sun. We long for perfection. We long for righteousness, for a world where everything is right. And we keep encountering wrong over and over and over again. It's where we live. It's the address where we reside. He said, I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. God's going to eventually sort it all out. He knows. But right now it's a season of wheat with the tares. It's all mixed up together. For there shall be a time there for every purpose and for every work. And he talks about who we are. Not only where we live, but who we are ourselves. I said in my heart, concerning the estate of the sons of men, God tests them. The fact that we are in this environment is a test for us. That they may see that they themselves are like beasts. What does he mean by that? That we're just like the animals. Well, I don't think he's saying that we're like the beasts in every way. I mean, how many of you watched The Jungle Book? Either the new one or the old one. What's one thing that sets mankind apart from beasts? The red flower, right? Fire. Our ability to control fire to some degree. There are differences between humanity and the beasts. Genesis chapter 2 talks about how when God created humanity, he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. That the Spirit of God resided within humanity. That there was a soul and a spirit and not just a body, not just a physicality to humanity. So I don't think that he's saying we're like beasts in every way. I think he's saying that there are some things that we share with the beasts. One of those things is, in the present, is our mortality. He says, what happens to the sons of men also happens to the beasts. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. In spite of all of our intelligence, all of our creativity, we cannot escape death. It still happens to us as well as the beasts. For all is vanity. We have no advantage. All go to one place. All are from dust, and all return to dust. So if you think of beasts also, there's another aspect. Why did God create humanity in the beginning, in Genesis chapter 1? What was our responsibility in the world? To tend the garden and to basically steward creation, to be a shepherd over the beasts. We were to care for God's creation and care for the beasts. Adam naming the beasts was a way of him taking care of what God had created and identifying what God had created. And so beasts need a shepherd. Beasts need somebody to care for them. If there is an endangered species in this world, those endangered species can't get together and say, we have to form a committee and figure out a way to protect ourselves and come up with some policies to make sure that we don't go the way of extinction. It's humanity that does that. It's humanity that realizes we have a shepherding responsibility in this world. But we are like the beasts in that we need to be shepherded ourselves. It's not just the beasts that need shepherding, that need someone over them. We need somebody over us. And I think that's part of what the preacher's talking about here too, is realizing our place. So we're not God. We need God. We need someone over us to sort things out and to work things out. There are things that we cannot unravel. He talks about that in verse 21. Who knows whether the spirit of man or the spirit of man, which goes upward, and the spirit of the beast, which goes down to the earth. He's not saying that I think, you know, humanity is eternal and beasts are mortal and they're going to die and just go into the grave. Like, you know, what happens to Fluffy, your rabbit, when it dies? When your little daughter says, you know, what happens? Or our dog Ada, who died a few years ago. I honestly don't know. And that's the preacher's point. We can't know exactly what God's going to do. There are some things God does tell us about after life after death, and that's much more clear in the New Testament, especially for humanity, that there is a place and time of judgment. There's a time where we stand before God, and God looks at every person, and there's basically one main thing that he looks at. What did you do with Jesus? What was your decision regarding my son? And then if there was faith, then he judges the details of that person's life according to their faith. And there's rewards for that. If there is no faith, then there's the judgment of their lack of faith. And so we do know that from Scripture. But as far as the other aspects of life, I don't know what happens, you know, when I step on an ant or squish a bug, if that's the end of its existence, or if God somehow weaves that into his future plan. I don't know. We cannot unravel those things, but we can stay focused in what we have been given, our calling. Verse 22, so I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. There are things we have been given to do. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? There is someone above us both who has control of all of life. Job himself said this, but ask the animals and they will teach you, or the birds of the sky and they will tell you. In his hand is the life of every creature and the breath of all mankind. So what does it mean to rejoice? When the preacher says here to rejoice in our own works, I think part of that means to leave the future with God and focus on our responsibility today. Jesus himself taught us this, Matthew chapter 6, where he says, do not worry about tomorrow. Focus on, you know, the present has enough trouble. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. I think it involves that. I think it also involves what Jesus says in John chapter 16, verse 33. These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation. You will have trouble. That's usually not a refrigerator magnet that you stick. One of the promises of God. I'm claiming that one today. But be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. So in the midst of our trouble, we can still be of good cheer because God is going to work it out. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2. Jesus' own life. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross. If you think of the word cross, we get the word excruciating out of it. That's what the cross was for Jesus. It was excruciating. And yet, it was for the joy set before him. He endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So in the midst of Jesus' own pain, in the midst of his own trouble, there was a joy. There's the ability to rejoice. The preacher's point here in chapter 3 is that we are not to seek to evade all trouble. We've been born to it. But we can cheerfully, courageously, and humbly face it. I want to read a quote from an author. His name's N.D. Wilson. And I've quoted this before, but good books are worth rereading. And good quotes are worth requoting. So this is from his book, Death by Living. He says, "Man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. And Job would know. He knew trouble like most people know their beds. He tossed in it. He couldn't escape it. Death, disease, pestilence. Trouble heaped in heavy piles to break him. He was pushed down under those waves all the way down until his wife was cursing and his pious friends were rebuking him, down until his children were gone, his wealth was gone, his health was gone, down like a submarine dropping into cold nothing, dropping toward his crushing depth, toward the absolute breaking point of his righteousness, down until all he had was the whirlwind." Only two men and one woman have ever lost more than Job. Adam, Eve, and Adam, the last, Jesus. Heat rises. Man is born to trouble. When Job lifted his face to the storm, when he asked and was answered, he learned that he was very small. He learned that his life was a story. He spoke with the author and learned that the genre had not been an accident. God tells stories that make Sunday school teachers sweat. And mothers write their children permission slips, excusing them from encountering reality. I found out that actually Sunday school today, the theme upstairs, because they're going through the Old Testament, is the story of Gomer and Hosea. Which, it's like, I'm not sure who wove that in. And Gretchen found out a little bit too late to say, like, maybe we'll just skip this story this week. So they're going to tactfully talk about that trouble in the Old Testament. But there are stories that we blush at and we think, why is this even in the Bible? But it's the reality of life. It's the reality of the world that we live in. And certainly there's different layers and levels in how you introduce trouble to children. So if your kids are upstairs, don't panic right now. My wife is one of the teachers up there. But that's what he's saying here. Continuing. Lions are fed. Every day, animal stories end in those jaws. Leviathan snorts fire. Unicorns won't plow. What good is a story without struggle? What's the latest Marvel movie that just came out this weekend? Infinity War. Like, any one of those movies, it's only good if there's a significant trouble that has to be overcome, right? Yes. If it's just a tepid trouble, it's like, nah, it's not worth seeing, right? What good is a plot without danger? How is a character's metal tested? How is it made in the first place? Nails are forged for pounding. Man is born to trouble. Man is born for trouble. Man is born to battle trouble. Man is born to fight, to be forged and molded under torch and hammer and chisel into a sharper, finer, stronger image of God. We are born for trouble. Even Adam was born for trouble. He was born in a perfect world, but it was a world where trouble was permitted and allowed for him to fight, and he took the apathetic response. He just folded his hands. He did not engage with that dragon, with that beast, with that serpent. We were born for trouble. Preacher lets us know that, and we should rejoice in it. cheerfully, courageously, humbly. Not only rejoice, though, but there is also a need to sigh. So he says in verse 4, moreover, I'm sorry, not in verse 4, in verse 1 of chapter 4, moreover, or then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there is power, but they have no comforter. Therefore I praise the dead who are already dead, more than the living who are still alive. Yes, better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. He says, I have more to talk about in regard to trouble, because I don't want you to misunderstand rejoicing, that there is a sign aspect, that we shouldn't treat trouble so cheerfully in one sense, going about our task, that we treat trouble in a triteful way. It is a painful thing. Some kinds of trouble are a nuisance. Before we got in the car today, or after we got in the car, I looked at the tire and it's almost sitting on the ground. Realized that's just the nuisance trouble. So you have to go into the backyard and pump it up, and that's a small thing. But there are other kinds of trouble that are absolutely overwhelming. And think of people who experience PTSD because of the troubles that they have had to undergo in life. Those who are first responders. My brother, who's been a fireman for a number of years, he was sharing a story with me just a few weeks ago, how they had received a call and went to this house, and there was a man in this back room, and as you step into the home, it's a stench. And one of the worst things about that job is sometimes the stenches that you have to encounter when you're on the job. And they stepped into this room, and by the time my brother left, his work boots were muddy, but it wasn't mud. It was human waste. And this guy was on a cot, and he's in the cot, and there's little bags of his own waste all over the floor, all over the entire room. And there's leftover food there, and he's like stuck in bed. And it was a horrible situation. And he's looking at this, and he's thinking it's a situation of domestic violence and abuse, if somebody's just neglecting this individual. And certainly that happens at times, where there are individuals who, because of the neglect of people around them, have to live in that environment. In this particular situation, this person had such an acidic relationship with his family. His family couldn't get close. They wanted to help. And the only person he would allow in was one of his grandchildren, a grandson. And this grandson, when the guy was asleep, he would clean up as much as he could. But if he was awake, this guy would just yell and just was so violent in his words and everything that nobody could do anything. And so there are stories where you just step into situations, you hear things, and you are overwhelmed. It's hard to fathom. My father had the opportunity to go to Israel a number of years ago, and he toured the Holocaust Museum there in Jerusalem. One of the saddest parts of that entire museum is the section that's dedicated to the children, and all the children that died in that war and through the internment camps and the burnings. David Gibson said that smallest coffins are the heaviest. And there are some things in life that are unbearable to keep looking upon. And I think if we took the time to continue to look at trouble, remember Solomon's, or the preacher here, is examining so everything so thoroughly, we probably check out before then. We say, I can't handle it. He's going deeper than most of us would have gone or will ever go. And his response, emotional response, is, I look at death as a release and a relief. At least this person isn't going through what they were going through. Or maybe it's better that that person was never even born. I'm thankful for the people who are still born. This is his thought process at that time. And Job himself said this in Job chapter 3, when he opens his mouth after his friends come in the midst of his trouble, his first words from verses 3 through 19 there is him saying, I wish I had been stillborn. I wish I had never been born. That was his response to his own trouble. And so it's a painful thing. We want to see people be able to escape it and to not have to endure. That's what the preacher's saying. I think it's important for us to understand, in looking at death as a relief, we can only know that if we know what is on the other side of death. He just said earlier, who knows what happens to man after he dies? How do we know what happens to man? God knows. And God has shared with us in Scripture. But it is not a relief. And the Bible speaks of death as the last enemy. It's not a relief if there's no relationship with God. It's just an entrance into another type of trouble. And so the preacher, he's talking about the need to not just rejoice in trouble, but to sigh, to grieve, to know that there is a time in life where it is absolutely appropriate and right to groan, and to have no words to say, maybe just to let tears fall and to weep. Jesus did this. John 11:33, when he was at the tomb of Lazarus, what did he know what he was going to do in a few moments? He's going to raise him from the dead. That's why he had waited. He knew the plan that God had in mind. He was rejoicing in that work. He hadn't forgotten it. But what did he do in that moment? He wept. And it says he groaned. There's another time when he was healing an individual in Mark 8:12. It says he sighed. And that word for sigh, it's the same word as in Romans 8:22, where it says all creation groans, being in the condition that we are in right now. It is okay and it is right to groan in the times of great trouble. Solomon lets us know, or the preacher lets us know, there is a time for sighing, a time for grief. But not only that. There's a need to share. Verses 4 through 16. These verses here are wrapping it up, where he says it's important not to grieve alone, but to go through life together. That we were created for community. After creation, when God made all the different things in the different days, he says at the end of each of the days what? It is what? It's good. And then you get to chapter 2, verse 18, and God says something about his creation. What does he say? It's not good. Specifically what? He says it's very good at the end of creation. Yes, chapter 7, or day 7. But it's not good that man should be what? Alone. We were created for community. And not just community with God. We were created for community with one another, to have people around us to walk through life together in the face of trouble. And so he's talking about that in these verses. First of all, he talks about the enemies of community. One enemy of community is envy. Verse 4. Again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. What's one of the things that fractures community? It's envy. When I see that somebody else has what I don't have or what I want, rather than rejoicing with them, rather than celebrating and having a camaraderie and a connection, I see it as a competition that's unhealthy. And so there is this stepping upon one another. And rather than us being able to face trouble together, we create more trouble in life. So envy is one aspect of the enemies of community. Another aspect or enemy of community is laziness. He says in verse 5, the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. The word for fold, it's closely related to that word embrace, which we saw in chapter 3. And it means to love. And so this individual, He's folding his hands in one sense as a refusal to work. He's not extending his hands in work, but he's also folding his hands in a love for himself. He's not extending his hands in love for another. He's not embracing another. He's not coming alongside another. He's being lazy. He's folding his hands and he's loving himself. And it says, in an abrupt way, he consumes his own flesh. He's so lazy, he has nothing left in life except himself, and so he has to consume himself. He's feeding himself to himself. That's how lazy he is. So on the one side, you've got envy. On the other side, you've got laziness, where he has nothing to give to another because he's only giving to himself. And then you also have manic busyness, verses 7 and 8, another enemy of community. Then I returned and I saw under the sun there is one alone without companion who has neither son nor brother, yet there is no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches, but he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. You don't have to have anything to practice envy. But here, this person's taken envy to the extreme and toiling for the rest of their life to get things and to get ahead. And at the end, they do succeed in that, but they succeed alone. They have no one to really share it with because they're only working for themselves. One question for you and I to consider is, what jobs or tasks in our life have gotten in the way of relationships? And for some of us, we need to be a little bit more busy. We're on the lazy side. For others of us, it's not laziness that's our problem. It's fracturing relationships and hindering community. It's our busyness. Preacher's letting us know these enemies. Another enemy is closed-mindedness. Look at verses 13 through 16. Better is a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. So you have a man who's ascended to the top. He's a king, but he's no longer able to listen. He can't receive. And here's somebody else who's wise and poor, but has no input and access to the person. For he comes out of prison to be king. This could be in reference to the king, the existing king, where he started in a lowly place himself, but he worked his way to the top, although he was born poor in his kingdom. Or it could be a reference to the new youth, that he's in prison, he's poor, but he's going to end up replacing the person who's on top. And I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. And there was no end of all the people over whom he was made king. Yet those who come after will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. So in part, it's talking about popularity here. But also in part, it's talking about this closed-mindedness. You've got different generations not able to pass baton to the next and to realize there is a temporary place that I have in life. And so community here, healthy community is going to be cross-generational, where the wise, the young are learning from the old, and the old are learning from the young. But closed-mindedness can be another enemy of community. So how do we combat this? He talks about that in verse 6. He says, better is a handful of quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. One handful means that there's some degree of work in your life. But also one handful means that there's some degree of rest in your life. It's not two hands full. It's not toil, toil, toil. It's a mixture of proper work to give to others and rest. And this balance. Learning to love others. When Jesus was with his disciples on his last night, they were celebrating the Passover meal. And after the meal, he rose from supper. He changed his garments. He took a towel. He girded himself and he washed their feet. And then he sat back down and said, did you see what I did? I've given you an example for what you should do to serve others, to love others. And then he says this, if you know these things, happier are you if you do them. To love others is a secret to happiness. It's a secret to being able to have this fullness in life. And he says, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you. We can only do that as we've been served by him. But then he gives us the ability to do that. And so verse 6 here in chapter 4, it's talking about the need to serve the better way of loving our neighbor and walking through life in community. I want to wrap up with some benefits of community and then we'll be done. He lists four here. In verse 9, he talks about there's a benefit of productivity. Two are better than one because they have a good reward from their labor. Think of some jobs that you do. There's some jobs that you probably prefer to do alone, but there's certainly some jobs that are much more enjoyable and actually are easier, and there's greater efficiency when you're working with others. I re-roofed a roof last year, and I had a group of people who came and helped me, and it was much more enjoyable to be on that roof, popping all the staples, thousands of staples, and then laying down the new shingles with somebody else. So in the heat and the sun, looking over, I'm not alone. They're over there doing that too. So there's some degree of comfort knowing that you're going through life together, but there's also greater productivity. Maybe it's helping with moving. Maybe it is sheetrocking and you're sheetrocking a ceiling. Well, you can do that by yourself, but it's much easier to have two people doing that job. There's just some jobs that have a greater degree of productivity when you're working with others. Another benefit of community is help. Verse 10, for if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him. Think of life almost like climbing. Does anybody climb mountains using ropes in here? Okay, not the athletic. Okay, we got two people. My dad, I've done it some. My dad did rope climbing a lot more when I was younger. But he had a friend of his named Darren, who was just a teenager at the time. And my dad was friends with this guy's dad. And Darren's climbed mountains all around the world. He's climbed Mount Rainier probably over 100 times. He's a tour guide. He's attempted Everest and got 2,000 feet from the top, but realized it's worth keeping my legs and losing my legs and getting to the top. And so he was very experienced at the present. But when he was a teenager, my dad was climbing with him, and they were going through a snowfield. And my dad, they were all roped up, and my dad felt this little tug. And he turned around and he looked behind, and there was a few other people on the rope. But Darren was missing from the rope. He had fallen into a crevasse and you just couldn't see him. And he was so light, just as a young teenager, that there's just a little tug on the rope and dad looked back and he's not there. But that's why you rope up when you're on a climb. And in life, we need to be roped up with others. It's good to have help. It's good to be able to be connected with other people so that when we drop, somebody can catch us. When they drop, we can help catch them. There's the need when one of us falls to be able to help one another. There's also the benefit of warmth. Verse 11, again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? So he uses the illustration here. If you think of being out in nature and it's immensely cold, if you've got people that are able to be close together, it's more warm. But good friendships help us on life's cold nights. So this relates a lot more to life than just a married couple. This relates to all of us. We need those warm relationships, those friendships in life. And if you think of Job, his friends were comfort to him for the first 7 days. They came and they just sat with him. Sometimes you don't need anybody to say anything to you when you're going through trouble. Just need somebody to be with you. And then they open their mouth. And Job wishes they hadn't. Because he says in chapter 16, miserable comforters are you all. Because they didn't understand exactly what he needed. They thought they were going to fix his problems, and he was the problem to his problems. And that wasn't the case. So sometimes we do need people to speak into our life. Other times we just need to be present. But the good friends are, it's like a warm blanket. It's a warmth to us. And then a strength. Verse 12. Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. There's strength in numbers. And I think certainly this applies to marriage, where you have a husband and a wife, and God can be that threefold cord binding them together. It can also relate to marriage, just a husband and a wife, and then children. Children can add strength to a marriage. They don't have to be there, but they add a greater strength to just that family bond. But it doesn't have to apply just to marriage. There's other friendships and aspects of community and life where it's good to have people alongside you and to be able to have the strength in numbers. So there's all these benefits: productivity, help, warmth, and strength. The question that I want to leave you with is, how do we find this kind of community? Maybe you're here today and you're like, that sounds great, but I don't have it, and I don't know where to get it, and I feel stuck on the outside. You're talking, and maybe I see you as on the inside of a community, but I'm on the outside. How do I get into a community where I can have these benefits and these blessings, so that when I'm going through trouble, I can have a shoulder, I can have a hand, I can have strength, I can have warmth? I don't think that there's any quick fix way. I don't think I can give you a snap of the fingers and this is what you need to do. Just these three simple steps. And by the end of this week, you too can have friends. I don't think that's how it works. But there are some principles. I think one principle is that God has called us to initiate. And the opposite of laziness is initiative. And if we want friends, Proverbs says we must first be friendly. So if I am longing for people to help me in my work, to be warmth to me, to be strength to me, who can you be that to? Who can you take the initiative and say, here's somebody who needs a friend. I'm going to be a friend to them. And that's one of the ways that you create friends. So one is taking the initiative. Another aspect is investment. It involves work. It takes a giving. It's necessary. And I think it also takes time. It's not something that's just a quick snap of the fingers. It also requires transformation. Because naturally, we all are selfish. We're all just looking for ourselves. And I think we need the transforming work of Jesus that he talked about in John chapter 13, where he washed their feet. He served them so that they could then be equipped to serve others. Jesus was all of this to us. He took the initiative. He left heaven and came to earth. He could have chosen for all of eternity to never touch trouble. He had that choice, but he decided to enter into trouble. He made the investment, and he took time. He's still taking time today in this world, dealing with things, and he's transforming. He is that friend who sticks closer than a brother. He said to his disciples, "You are my friends, and greater love has no man than this, than to lay down one's life for his friend." So if you're here today and you're looking for friendship, you're looking for a community, we want to encourage you. There's ways to get connected to this church. We have different life groups. We have different studies. We have different fellowship groups. One way is to join a ministry team, just to start serving with somebody else in this church. And there's a variety. You can be on the worship team. There's children's ministry. They're always looking for other people. Set up. And there's a variety of ways that we can come alongside one another in life, and serving together is one way that we build relationships. Maybe this church, maybe you're visiting here for a few weeks or months, and you just feel like this is not your connection. That's fine. There's a lot of great churches here in town, other great churches in town. And I know a lot of great pastors and great individuals. So I just encourage you, find another church where you can connect. God's doing great things in this area, and I'm appreciative of that. So let me close in prayer, and then we will end with one song. Lord, we thank you for your word today. We thank you that this preacher of Ecclesiastes, this teacher, is talking about the real things that we experience in life and how to deal with them. And Lord, I know that all of us, in one degree or another, experience trouble in life, from the trite things, the small things, the little nuisances, to the deep, overwhelming things. And Lord, I thank you that you have created us for community. You've created us not to face trouble alone, but to face it with you, to face it with hope, to face it with one another, and to help others in their times of trouble. And God, I pray that this church and the other churches in our local area would be places where people who are in trouble would be able to find refuge. Where when we are in trouble, we would be able to call somebody up or just extend ourselves out to say to someone else, I need help. I'm going through something. Lord, we thank you that you're God who has not left us alone. Thank you for Christ who has entered this world and that you have called us your friends and you've given us your promises. Amen.